Love has always been the default. We have over time found ways of separation, but instinctively we know that love is the root.
Gather round the fire. This is the Light Service.
Welcome to Firecast 17 from myself, Pete Lawrence, and Diane.
Hi there.
2 weeks on from the first resuscitated Firecast, we're back and we're completely improvising. We're sort of incorporating a newsletter as an audio version of it. But the conversation, as ever with most campfire conversations, will be wide-ranging and spontaneous. So we're going to call it a sunny day, I think. Was that your suggestion there, Diane?
That'll do. We've both got sunshine this morning, so it's lovely.
Yeah, we're privileged. So the theme of privilege will crop up, I'm sure, in there once or twice. But I wanted to start with some of the news from the campfire end of things. We've just announced that we're doing a chilled cider event, which isn't strictly a campfire event, but it's a sort of spin-off, and we're calling it Nectar. And it's in the wonderful Dorset Nectar Orchards, just north of Bridport. So it's in the middle of Dorset, and it's over the weekend of July the 8th and 9th. And it's for 70 people maximum. We tried to do an event there last year. I went up there just as a casual visitor a few weeks ago and happened to engage their son in conversation. He said, oh yeah, we can host something now. So we're being welcomed back to the orchard for a camping weekend that will also have mainly a musical theme. It will be very relaxed, not like a campfire camp out, which is much more about, in some cases, quite intense conversations and wide-ranging themes and well-being and lots of other things. So this is sit around in an orchard, have a cider or an apple juice and hopefully enjoy some sunshine in a wonderful setting over the weekend.
Yeah, the photos look lovely that you put up of it. And I have to say, I'm hoping to get along because it's in the same county that I'm in. So that's quite exciting.
Of course, you're a Bournemouth girl.
Yes. Yeah. Well, technically, I was born in Poole, if we want to get technical about this. So I was born in Dorset and then I went across to Hampshire because Bournemouth was in Hampshire at that time. And then it moved back to Dorset. So, yes. But that's where I live now. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we do have a couple of early bird tickets left still. There's only a slight discount on those, and it's a fairly cheap weekend anyway, including camping. And it's my friend who was there with me actually remarked on the quality of the loos, which is they do look quite special actually, and they've got sort of enamel bowls, you know, for washing your hands, and it's just a cut above a lot of campsites in many respects, and three showers, and it's a very pleasant place to hang out.
Excellent.
So we're doing that July the 8th and 9th weekend. The newsletter highlights quite a few articles on the campfire site. How Science Should Work, Becky Roberts. Time to Pull the Plug on Water Privatisation. Sean Whiteman has posted a link to an article there. Wondering About the Knights Templar from Janine Edwards. Why Governments and Corporate Media Ignoring Excess Deaths Worldwide. That old chestnut, posted by Sarah Redman. An interesting thread from Sean Whiteman, addressed to what he calls COVID fans. My question to you is exactly what is it you want to achieve, which we could fill a whole firecast with, I'm sure. Russell Brand interviewing Kennedy, and the new 4D AI smart traffic cameras, European Parliament COVID summit, digital nomads rejected the office and now want to replace the nation state. Now, this one's really caught my imagination. Quite interesting. There are a couple of articles that have been posted by Sean by Dave Cook from The Conversation magazine. I think Dave's a PhD in anthropology, but he talks about digital nomads and their tangled relationship with state institutions. He says the nation state is the next institution that digital nomads want to recycle. It's, I suppose, a reaction against citizenship, passports, tax, cameras on you and the whole time, 15-minute cities, whatever it is you want, you see as part of that nation state that can control you. And certainly my experience is in Paros. You know, I've been lucky enough to have this house here for 18 years and I'm still not on the water main. So I'm hearing about the horrendous bills that people are getting for their water supply, as well as obviously gas and electricity, well, mainly electricity on the island. And it does feel very appealing to be off-grid. But some of the comments actually are quite interesting in the thread. Claire Johnson has talked about, isn't this just another sort of mainstream narrative about owning nothing and being happy? And do you have any views on that, Diane?
Own nothing and be happy. Well, as somebody who's been through various things to do with finance, including having a house repossessed by a mortgage company and being declared bankrupt a number of years ago. It's kind of interesting. In this world, in this country, certainly, it's really tricky. You know, how do you, you know, there's all sorts of things in amongst that. I mean, I live in a tiny space, which is great, but it's amazing how stuff still arrives. But I have to say, I can let go of things these days, which is good, better than I used to. My dad's a terrible hoarder. My mum's much better at clearing things out. They're total opposites, the two of them. And they've been together for many, many years now. And I find it interesting looking at, you know, kind of how they operate. But own nothing. Be happy.
It's sort of Agenda 2030, isn't it, really? It's it's their idea that you won't actually own your own car, you won't own your own anything, you'll just have to sort of hire it in, and if your credit isn't up to date and you haven't had your jabs or whatever it is that they use as their matrix for calculating your good citizenship, then they can just turn the tap off.
Yeah, I mean, that was shown, wasn't it, quite clearly that was something that the governments are prepared to do when you look at something like Canada and what happened there. And I was quite intrigued because when Trudeau came in originally, a friend of mine who used to live in Canada, and she knew, you know, his father in power and thought, you know, good guy, oh, this is hopeful. But some of the things that's happened over there, including that, was quite concerning. And then I've got another friend who is African, but he actually lives in China. He teaches English. And, you know, hearing stuff there about Chinese authorities and how they carry on, you know. And it's this thing, I think there's a naivety amongst a lot of people in the likes of the UK, where people think, oh, this can't possibly happen here, you know, these all, you know, sort of China authoritarian, you know, Russia authoritarian. Yeah, what do you think is going on with us? You know, I lived in Doncaster during the miners' strike, and yeah, we were stopped from moving around. I had a friend who was a justice of the peace at the time. He was a mine worker. He was a safety officer, which is a very important role, obviously, in the mines. And he was trying to head off on holiday, and three times he got turned back in the car by the police with roadblocks. This was in the sort of Yorkshire area. And, you know, it's kind of, where are you going? I'm going on holiday, not down this road, mate. And that was the response. If you weren't amongst it, you don't realise quite what that was like. You know, that was a really not a pleasant time. Yeah, and it opened my eyes to quite a lot of things at that time.
I remember being on the M1, and I think we were with Richard Thompson on tour. We were with Adrian Legg, who was supporting Richard Thompson. And it was like a police state, just Black Mariah's police vans tearing up and down the M1. And it really did feel quite dark. And of course, that was around the time of the Battle of the Beanfield as well.
Yeah.
And these uprisings that were happening, and the poll tax riots.
It was absolutely
the last bastion of protest before the years of the Blairites. What would you call it? The insouciance that was happening. When Labour became the Conservatives, and no one seemed to want to have any reason for protesting for a generation almost.
Yeah, I mean, I was funny this week. I was watching a video, and I saw some pictures of stuff, and actually it gets mentioned in Ithaca, the programme that you highlighted about Julian Assange, about the protests that happened around the world about the Iraq war, you know, and that, you know, I mean, in London, I was there during those protests and it was phenomenal. People coming who'd never protested in their lives. But it was so, even though it was enormous, I mean, absolutely enormous, you know, it's amazing how it got swept under the carpet almost, you know, it's incredible. It's incredible. So, yeah.
Yeah. What did it achieve is a good question to ask, if anything, other than people coming together in a common cause. But
also, yes, I think there was that for sure. And it was the kind of older generation who were very markedly there, who'd not necessarily protested previously. Yeah, what did it do? Well, it certainly did for me, just made my views even stronger about the state and how I view them.
Yeah, which brings us back to, in a way, what the digital nomads are trying to do, I guess, is to create an internet country and shed any sort of nationality status. So it's the no-nation ethos,
mm-hmm.
Which for me is pretty much a good thing, but some might argue, again, it takes away that sense of nationality that some people have a pride in.
Yeah, that's always a tricky one, isn't it? Because we all need somewhere we feel we belong. We're very tribal as a human being. We like to belong. And, you know, I've worked with lots of people over the years who felt they don't belong and looking for their tribe, and they find it in all sorts of different ways in different communities. So there's something about belonging to a nation that kind of works, but there's also the whole chauvinism and fascism and things that can come out of that make it difficult. So, yeah, balance. Mm.
Yeah, always a tricky thing and always one of our themes is balance. So, yeah, a quick reference to the Simon Elmer book, which I talk about almost parodically, The Road to Fascism, which sort of highlights all this that's going on, and with the WHO becoming one of the major sort of global bodies dictating a whole range of things, not just health, but they're leading from a health viewpoint. But the controls that are now in place around that are embodied in a lot of the stuff that WHO are coming forward with. And we have to be, it's awareness, isn't it? It's all about awareness. And also, the last thing I want to say on the digital nomad thing for now is, as a sense of privilege, obviously, for the people who are able to travel and do their work, obviously, they need a laptop and an internet connection. In the hierarchy of needs, it's almost like Wi-Fi has replaced food as a sort of basic ingredient for their well-being, really. But there is a degree of privilege, and they would argue that the therapeutic aspects of work and travel together outweigh the disadvantages. But then one of the articles by Dave Cook highlights, I think it's Agnes Nyanwangi, an African who's a digital nomad, and she quite rightly talks about Europe being closed to Africans.
Yeah.
So things have shifted a lot in the pandemic years in terms of access to different travel routes.
Mm. Yeah, I need to read more of these articles, actually. You know, you're talking about this. I definitely need to get on board with that.
It's a good read. This morning, my good friend Matt Koldrick, who's in Paros, did a wonderful post which sort of chimed with the spaciousness theme that our last Sunday Zoom, which we might want to talk about a little bit, threw up. But he talks about the perfect symbols of contemplation and sensitivity, his connections to the natural world, and his morning practice, really, which involves meditation and chant. And sometimes he'll sing and sometimes he'll have a response from the crabs or the birds. He talks about spooking out a heron as he trod on the heron's patch. And then something I didn't quite understand about hexagram 20 and the art of contemplation. But Matt quite rightly said, what rights do I have to displace other creatures? And he talks about, you know, without there being a reciprocal offering, the human consumption idea of just plundering nature rather than feeling part of it.
Yeah, that's that whole thing, isn't it, about having the pyramid with human beings at the top, or a circle. We're all part of a circle with nature and in nature. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's well worth watching Matt's lovely video, actually, that he's posted from the bay in Paros while he talks about his daily practice. And it's, for me, that's the sort of thing I'd like to hear when I wake up, rather than, you know, Radio 4's thought for the day or whatever it happens to be. Let's give it to Matt Coldrick, who could be one of the world's top broadcasters. We actually had a great chat after I'd done yoga. God, I sound privileged, don't I? Last week. about resuscitating our podcast idea that we've been talking about. So that's something that's very much on the drawing board. And I really enjoy my conversations with Matt because he's got such a fertile imagination, but a really rounded understanding of spirituality.
Right.
And it's, for him, it's all about creating stillness and self-awareness.
That's back to the spaciousness bit on from Sunday, isn't it? It's just the same stuff.
It was a very interesting conversation. And for those who missed it or wonder what we talk about on our Sunday Zooms, I have edited up a sort of half-hour version with some of the main points, I guess, of some of the nitty-gritty stuff. And there was plenty of it, really. It was a very fruitful session.
Yeah, it was lovely. And it's a great topic, spaciousness, you know, because that could go in so many different directions with all the spaciousness that's created. Yeah, it's kind of cool.
And it's a starter, really, isn't it? That, to create that space, who knows what can happen, as you say. Tell us about the Julian Assange documentary. I posted about it, but didn't get around to watching it in the end.
Yeah. Well, I have to say thank you for posting because I wasn't aware it was on. And actually, thanks from a friend of mine who's been strongly supporting and following the whole Assange, I don't know what you call that, story, journey, debacle. I don't know, call it all sorts of things, couldn't you? But yeah, it's I found it a really powerful piece. It was interesting because to start off with, I found the style of it a bit irritating because I kind of look at things in different ways, you know. So the style. So it wasn't about the content, it was actually about the style of it. But after a while, I found that actually did feel like the right way to go, and I could get why they'd done it the way they did. But I had to stop watching it partway through because I just found it utterly heartbreaking on different levels. Because obviously you've got the whole, well, what is this all about? It's about control, you know, back to the government control thing again. And, you know, Julian Assange has obviously done this stuff because, you know, he's trying to highlight where governments are not following the rules that they've even agreed to, supposedly, and bringing up, you know, various awful things. You've got Julian's state that he's in, and so the program goes into kind of what happened a bit in the Ecuadorian embassy and how the film, you know, there's film of him and his wife in the Ecuadorian embassy. And there's also the thing about the firm, the security firm that were brought in, were then got at by America. And so they were passing on information to America about what was going on. And he was obviously having meetings in this space with lawyers and politicians and all sorts of other people. It was, you know, but it's no surprise that whoever it was and however they coerced the security firm. But the may, you know, then his wife, and obviously there's two kids there and kind of how she's coping. But she obviously knew what she was getting into. You know, she had eyes wide open. So she's a lawyer. She went into this knowing where things were at.
She met him while he was inside, didn't she?
Yeah.
Correspondence, I think.
She was part of the sort of team. Yeah. And there's a very moving piece where she goes to Geneva and speaks in front of the statue that's there of Assange and the others. But it's his dad. It was his dad. It just got to me. You know, because this poor man, you know, has been thrown into this. He's trying to support his son. And he's, you know, at one point he'd been in in England for a year. So he's away from, he has a young child as well. So Julian's half sister. And so he's been communicating with her for a year by phone. That's it, pretty much, you know, and the whole, but just the whole thing of him feeling that, you know, it's awful, you know, because the reality is that, you know, they've assessed Julian as potentially someone who will suicide, you know, and it's not surprising. I mean, you know, he has Asperger's, which people with Asperger's tend to have a higher rate of suiciding anyway, because life is very difficult being neurodiverse in those ways. And it was overwhelming. That's why I had to stop. But then I had to finish what, you know, I kind of went and did something else and then kind of cleared that through my system and just dealt with it and then went back into it. And it was interesting as I started watching again, I thought, oh, okay, it's not so bad now, I'm okay. But actually within a short time, I found all these feelings coming up again, but I did watch it through to the end. But there's a huge amount in there and there's a whole bunch of statistics that they throw up at the end. And so I just want to go back and watch the whole program again and get a better feel of it. But yeah, I found it's very gently powerful in a very interesting way. And I had a sense that probably John, Julian's dad, probably has Asperger's as well. I can't remember whether they said that on there or not, but, and it makes life difficult to actually be able to make sense. I mean, a lot of us, you know, we struggle to make sense of the world anyway, but when you've got a different thinking process going on, which is an extra layer to deal with, to try and understand this crazy world. Yeah, powerful, powerful.
But this was on, was it ITV?
Yes. Yeah, so you can watch it on ITVX. Yeah, it's there. Yeah.
Interesting that you didn't hear about it, but it doesn't surprise me in a way, because some of the Guardian used to be absolutely full, weren't they? The paper that supported the original when all the papers came out through WikiLeaks, and now not a word. So someone's obviously had a very strong word in their ear. They're not supporting Assange as far as I can see. It's mainly people like Roger Waters that I'm hearing most of the support from, right. And Brian Eno.
Yeah, the way I operate in life these days, because I know you don't engage a lot in newspapers and television news and all that sort of thing either. It's just kind of, I find sitting and being, things will float, and what I need to see and be aware of will float to me. it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from a book that's about Africa, actually. Yeah, anyway.
Good to have one of your quotes. Always good to have one of your quotes.
I've just suddenly thought that. Yeah, this, because I don't want to misquote. And I'm not sure.
Well, I'm happy to waffle a bit while you find the quote.
Okay, you carry on and waffle then, Pete, for a little while, and I'll see if I can find a quote.
I was just going to say that, yes, that was what really cropped up in our conversation about spaciousness was, and in one of the preparatory exchanges I had with Jackie, who sort of led the session with me, she was talking about how no longer will she read the Sunday papers and just enter into that arena. And I used to avidly consume, I'll admit, The Guardian and other similar papers, Novara Media website. And now I'd rather just let things flow. That's not to say I feel I'm out of touch with what's going on, because somehow you tune into a different vibration that's equally important, and you're less concerned about what Boris Johnson did with his parties or what, you know, Boris Johnson's latest child or whatever it is, or what's happening with the royal family. You're more tuned into other areas, which aren't what the mainstream are making the agenda.
Yeah, difficult stuff, but hey, we need to look at it sometimes. Yeah. So I found the quote. So this comes from Elspeth Huxley's book, The Flame Trees of Theca. The best way to find out things, if you come to think of it, is not to ask questions at all. If you fire off a question, it's like firing off a gun. Bang, it goes, and everything takes flight and runs for shelter. But if you sit quite still and pretend not to be looking, all the little facts will come and peck round your feet. Situations will venture forth from thickets, and intentions will creep out and sun themselves on a stone. And if you are very patient, you will see and understand a great deal more than a man with a gun.
Yeah, very poignant. And that reminds me of our discussion about everyday people, which is a subsection of this Firecast, or will be at some point in the future. We were talking about how to structure everyday people in a meeting last week and some ideas for it. And that prompted me to talk about my own interviewing experience when interviewing others. And asking questions is one thing, but sitting there and allowing silence, you always get your absolute nuggets if you just don't ask a question, but you create some space, and they will, more often than not, people will be inclined to fill it with, usually with very interesting material.
Absolutely. But also that space, you know, it does allow, again, spaciousness allows thinking and allows thought to arrive. There's a coach that I know, and a number of years ago, he admitted he'd fallen asleep with a client. He was doing phone coaching. It wasn't in front of the person. And the person at the end of it said, "Well, that was the best session we've ever had." And it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. And I love the fact that, you know, he admitted to it. But it's true, you know, it's just giving people a space, you know, and that's what, you know, it's about allowing a space to be, so people can then, you know, actually fill it with whatever, you know. In the past, I've done dialoguing and things like that, you know, and it is great process, you know, to allow stuff to arise, and very rich. And yeah, you can get into completely different understanding or illumination or whatever. Yeah, lots of good stuff.
So more from the newsletter, the very sad death, sudden death of Andy Braswell, who was Camp Fire's events manager. His family have actually set up a memorial, which is happening on the 17th of June, I think up in Matlock, Bath, Derbyshire, very close to where Andy lived. Never known anyone as fit as Andy. He was out there in the wild, great adventurer. And yeah, his heart just stopped beating suddenly in the middle of the night while he was asleep in December, which really threw a lot of people. And we didn't actually hear about his death for a few weeks afterwards. But there's a post on Campfire for anyone who remembers Andy and wants to send any stuff in or attend the memorial, which is on the 17th of June. We're closing out with our music track of the week. It's from Bob Hillary, who you can see at Campout this year. He's made a wonderful album called Sacred, and this is the track we're going to select, which is my favourite track. It's called Heartshine Lullaby.
It's time to be just who you are. Can you see? You are beautiful and for sure. Time to shine it out for all to see. It's time to leave the old ways behind. It's time to be super powerful, you and me, flying on the breeze of easy now. Let's get back to our natural state of being. I've had enough of pushing. Let's take it down a notch or two. Follow your heart shine. Do what makes you feel good. drop the monkey mind now and follow your own way again. So hold yourself as you would a child, and hold your own love close inside of you.
So that's it for another Firecast. Thanks to Diane and myself. We're going to go off and enjoy some sun while it's still around. Don't forget, you can check out the last week's Campfire Zoom on Spaciousness, which is on our YouTube channel, or you can find the link through the campfireconvention.network social network. Everyone's welcome to join if you haven't yet. Lots going on there. Also, if you'd like to be part of Camp Out, which is happening August the 10th to the 13th in Oxfordshire, we still have open applications for performers, contributors, and also for crew. So you'll find the links. I think they are tinyurl.com/campoutcrew and campout.live/performers for anyone who wants to offer their unique genius as a gift to the event.
It's always lovely when you get different people just coming with so many different thoughts, ideas, experience, a real melting pot, cooking pot, whatever you want to call it, a wonderful stew.
Yes, whatever analogy. And of course, we're co-creating the stew, so it'll have all sorts of surprise ingredients in there.
Absolutely.
Thanks for another engaging conversation. I hope everyone's enjoyed it. We'll include your contributions.
Hey, thanks, Pete. Good talking with you again.
Thanks, Diane.
Hold yourself as you would a child. Yeah, hold your own love close inside of you.
Campfire Radio, the light service.